Introduction to this book of Theodor Illion. For many years I have been very intrigued by two books written by the German writer Theodor Illion, 1898-1984, In Secret Tibet, 1937, Original Ratzelhaft Tibet, 1936, and Darkness Over Tibet, 1937. Using the pseudonym Theodor Berang, he also wrote several books and articles on Tibetan medicine. There is some debate whether Theodor Illion never visited Tibet, but according to old articles and interviews, he was in the 1930s physically extremely well trained and fit for such an expedition. He was also obviously endowed with an iron will and determination to reach his goals. So on these accounts he could very well have succeeded in his endeavors to explore Tibet alone on foot. In January 1933 he visited Sweden for training trips in hiking and was interviewed by the Swedish newspaper Dagens Nyheter November 3, 1933. According to the article, Theodor Illion was born in Canada, raised in Japan, educated at Paris, New York, Berlin and Istanbul. He is a writer, journalist, hiker, philosopher and vegetarian. He is walking around 5 Swedish miles a day, only living on black bread and milk. For the past 8 weeks I have hiked through Germany, studying Nazism, an interesting journey that ended close to the Danish border. I wished to see how a political refugee could get to Denmark. He is now in Stockholm, where he will lecture at several places. The Theosophical Society. Illion has some critical, philosophical remarks on today's society. They invent technical means that grows over their heads instead of for one moment thinking of their own moral development. I have checked old issues of the Swedish theosophical magazine Teosofisk Tidskrift, but there is no mention of any lecture by Illion. There is very little information available on the life of Theodor Illion. A short article on Wikipedia and almost no useful references on the internet. In his book Nazis of Tibet, a 20th century myth, author Isran Engelhardt mentioned that it may be worth noting that Gestapo ordered Illion to furnish documentary evidence of his alleged visits to Tibet when he returned to Germany in 1941, since he was under suspicion of being a liar, who claimed he had visited Tibet although he had never been there. According to the Wikipedia article, Illion was a member of the Club of Rome, never married and had no children. A few more biographical details are presented in his books, but it is somewhat surprising that there are so few data on his life, as he lectured in several countries around Europe and was often interviewed extensively in large newspapers. In the preface to his first book, In Secret Tibet, Illion gives a brief presentation of himself. I traveled in Tibet neither as a Christian nor as a Buddhist. I did not look at things there merely with the eyes of the scientist or the philosopher. I tried to examine things in an absolutely unprejudiced way. I do not belong to any sect, party, or denomination. My interest in Tibet was centered around the reality of Tibetan mysteries and psychical phenomena. Page 18. 3 articles were published about my expedition, the Sunday Express mentioning the fact that I was looking for companions to accompany me to Central Asia. Page 26. Illion also mentioned an interview that was published in a large Stockholm paper in 1935 inches, but gives new further information. Theodor Illion. As with Dr. Rudolf von Linnau, there are no definite data to confirm that Theodor Illion never visited Tibet in the 1930s. There have been some speculation that he relied on the information in the books by Alexandra David Neal, published in the 1920s, and simply used the travelogue about Tibet as a way to present his philosophy. Whatever the truth, the books by Theodor Illion are a treasure trove of wisdom. Anyone thoroughly acquainted with the esoteric tradition will here find a kindred soul. I do find it amazing that Illion at his young age could have such extraordinary deep insights into esoteric philosophy, coupled with a critical mind and wonderful humor. I am a non-smoker. I only smoke in the company of people who consider non-smoking a virtue. In Secret Tibet is the story of Theodor Illion's travel in disguise in Tibet, meeting hermits, lamas and the somewhat more mysterious few wise men, very different from the often primitive and superstitious hermits. He encounters and is able to study many types of psychic phenomena, some apparently genuine but often produced by the grossest type of fraud. Ilion gives many practical examples and is very aware of the negative power of organized Orthodox religion in the world. Organized Buddhism, as it stands today, is a formidable machinery for exercising power by exploiting fear and credulity, especially Buddhism as it is in Tibet and Nepal. The Tibetans on the whole like to be told what to do. This prevents unnecessary thinking. The lamas greatly profit by this attitude. p. 116. This reminds me of a quote from the classic The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, where the adept K.H. comments on the problem of religion in world history. The chief cause of nearly two-thirds of the evils that pursue humanity ever since that cause became a power. It is religion under whatever form and in whatsoever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood and the churches. It is in those illusions that man looks upon as sacred, that he has to search out the source of that multitude of evils which is the great curse of humanity and that almost overwhelms mankind. Letter number 10, 1882. The truth of this statement must be obvious to anyone following today's news. Theodore Illion's sequel Darkness Over Tibet is a real adventure story and have by many readers been regarded as too fantastic and pure fiction. Illion is led to a secret underground community and is allowed an interview with the spiritual leader of the community, who he soon realizes is a very evil man and black magician. After having fled from this group, indulging in cannibalism, Illion gives an interesting comment on the two different philosophic or spiritual schools he have encountered in this world of matter, which is really the battleground for a formidable struggle of two different spiritualities. The few wise men of Tibet, who are great and dynamic personalities, intensely personal and yet acting impersonally, represent a kind of bodyguard of the creator which holds in check the other camp of methodically working annihilators and soul snatchers. p. 191. This, of course, is esotericism and a very good description of the planetary guardians or higher intelligence agency. Here, I highly recommend these two books by Theodore Illion to anyone with an interest in the esoteric tradition. As the author told of lecturing for the Swedish Theosophical Society, it is obvious that the ancient wisdom was his inspiration, and he appears to have been an accomplished esotericist both in theory and practice. There is also deep psychological insights and a gentle humanism in his writings. He is very well aware of the human condition on this interplanetary Alcatraz. Humaneness is the thing badly needed in this world, which dies from lack of love. We need people who are humane, really and spontaneously humane, in the little things of their daily lives. We have enough idealists who have occasional fits of idealism and tread the worm on the ground while they are looking for the stars. In book, Secret Tibet, page 128. T. Illion. In Secret Tibet. 1937, original Ratzel Haft's Tibet, 1936. Preface. To any sect, party, or denomination. I am merely man. And in this book I speak as man to man. There are readers who wish to amass innumerable details. There are others who look for vital connections which may provide a key to a deeper understanding of this puzzling world of phenomena and everlasting change. The latter may find in this book many a hint enabling them to fathom the mysteries of Tibet. T. Illion. In Secret Tibet. Chapter 1. W.H.Y. and How I Traveled in Disguise in Tibet. Tibet, the strange, bleak roof of the world, is still determined to keep the foreigner out. The trade route from Yatung to Jiangts is the only part of Tibetan territory really open to foreigners. Tibet holds many secrets. Strange things, seemingly contrary to all known laws of nature, are reported again and again by the few travelers who have been able to come into close contact with the country and its inhabitants. Mysteries abound in Tibet. Before visiting it, I often wondered whether the strange things reported by quite reliable individuals, who no doubt firmly believed they had witnessed the most extraordinary phenomena, were due to mere hallucination. The first actual unusual experience I had in Tibet could easily have been accounted for by such an explanation. While spending an icily cold night alone in my tent, I was awakened by ear-piercing cries of pain very similar to the cries of a human being in agony and yet strangely different to any human voice. The sound came from a place that could not have been farther than about 40 or 50 yards from my tent. I looked out. It was one of those clear Tibetan nights. The ground was covered with salt crusts reflecting the moonlight. The tent happened to be erected on a gentle slope and the surroundings were such that no man and no animal could hide anywhere within a distance of several hundred yards without being noticed. Notwithstanding this, there was nobody visible. I fell asleep again. 10 minutes later, the same shrill and almost human sound of pain was repeated. This time I looked skywards. No bird was visible in the moonlight and, in fact, no small bird could have given utterance to so powerful a cry. When the cry was repeated for the third time, I rushed out from the tent in the direction of the strange, ghostly voice. Once more I was baffled. When I had again returned to the tent, I heard a somewhat different cry, this time, rather mocking and even exulting, as if making fun of my helplessness. In the morning I examined the neighborhood in the hope of finding footprints. There were none. The only footprints I found were my own. These included those I had made during the night. A man determined to get into really close contact with Tibet and her many secrets must do without most of those comforts that a white person is in the habit of considering as absolutely necessary. For a certain time he must adapt himself entirely to Tibetan conditions, to Tibetan poverty and filth, and to Tibetan standards of living, with all the ensuing lack of comfort. And in many instances the white intruder actually will be worse off than the Tibetans themselves. But the prospect of closely studying the most mysterious country in the world justifies such a venture. I had been told that there were some men in Tibet who approximated to the age of 600, 900, or even 1,000 years. Did such persons exist? What did such venerable gentlemen look like? Was life still worth living for them at such an age? Would they look embarrassed if I asked them to prove their age? Of course, this speculation was based on the assumption that they existed. I had heard strange stories about white women who were supposed to live in some of the Tibetan monasteries in the company of hundreds of lamas deprived of other female company. How informing it would be to secure an interview with some of these ladies, and ask them to tell me something about their thrilling experiences. I had read about secret schools in Tibetan monasteries where pupils take an 8 years course in thought transmission, the pupil and his teacher being seated for weeks or months or years or decades in the same dark room, concentrating on the same mental pictures. Did those schools really exist? Was it possible to develop thought transmission in this way? Would it be possible for me to get a glimpse of those schools? And then there were the strange flying lamas. Did they exist? Would I succeed in meeting and studying at least one of these incredible beings? Other explorers had seen them, and the report of at least one of them was far too detailed and circumstantial to be hastily dismissed. The Lungampa must rightly be described as one of the strangest phenomena that are claimed to exist in Tibet. They do not run, but move past like an elastic ball bouncing off the ground at regular intervals, their arms and legs swinging like a pendulum. Although they move past at a speed of something like 15 miles an hour, they are never out of breath. Their faces are curiously immobile. Their eyes remain wide open and they seem to exist in a strange state of trance. Small wonder that such extraordinary stories as the above made me desirous to get into really close contact with Tibet, to discover her secrets. Although much risk and privation seems to be inevitable when traveling in disguise in one of the bleakest and least accessible countries in the world. In Chapter 6 of this book, in which I attempt to give an objective and matter-of-fact analysis of Tibetan miracles, I give a description of the Lungampa or flying lamas. I met them on two occasions and made the best possible use of the short time during which the phenomenon was visible. The Lungampa whom I saw, however, were not loaded up with heavy chains as I expected, on hearing Tibetan stories about them. Their attire was as light in weight as it possibly could have been. The Tibetans say that the flying lamas begin their flying exercises in light clothes, and as they become more familiar with the art of flying they make their clothes heavier, And finally they begin to wind chains round their body to make flying more difficult. I did not see any chains. But Tibetans often exaggerate. Slight and insignificant phenomena in Tibet have a tendency to develop into hair-raising and baffling miracles. In Tibet, actual and personal observation is the safest source of information, and even then great caution is necessary. One should never mix with a crowd when watching phenomena in Tibet. I never like to mix with crowds and avoid this whenever I can, not merely in the East, but also in the West. Have you ever, while present at a meeting of hundreds of people who happen to think along certain lines, attempted to form thoughts which are diametrically opposed to the ideas of the crowd? Even a skeptical and objective observer is at least subconsciously influenced by his environment, and especially by a crowd. The lamas in Tibet positively delight in crowds. The greater the concourse, the easier things seem to be for the Buddhist priesthood. The lamas dislike the independent thinker. They need flocks. I had been told that 20% of the population of Tibet were priests and monks. Would I find Tibet a more righteous and pious place than the rest of the world on account of the existence of so many lamas with whom helping others spiritually has become a profession? So my interest in Tibet was centered around the reality of Tibetan mysteries and psychical phenomena. Unlike some explorers, I was not out for prospecting or gold hunting. It is true, of course, that Tibet contains a fair quantity of valuable minerals and plenty of gold. Gold washing is carried on in various parts, and in some rivers gold is so plentiful that very coarse methods of gold washing yield considerable amounts of gold in a short time. I never really understood why gold is not currency in Tibet. Goods are paid for in copper coins, butter, or barley, but never in gold. On most of the copper coins it is written, by the way, that the government of the country is a good and victorious one, in order that the Tibetans may not forget it. I wonder why other governments do not adopt this cheap and simple method of self-adulation. To revert, I did not care a straw for the wealth of Tibetan valuable minerals and gold. Throughout my travels I carried no arms. Explorers of this type often get into trouble, and perhaps just because I did not go to Tibet for gain I never really got into trouble, although the odds sometimes seemed to be overwhelmingly against me. Although I am no materialist, I nevertheless start with at least one leg on firm ground. I am not foolhardy. I was fully aware of the fact that such a venture as traveling in disguise in the most inaccessible country in the world necessitated careful training, much preliminary study, and painstaking preparation. In spite of the admirable work done by a large number of explorers, only a portion of the information and maps required were available. Tibet still remains a terra incognita in many respects. For example, her population is estimated at 1.25 million by some people, and at 6 million by others. So ill-defined are her boundaries and her connection with adjacent territories is so vague that her area amounts to between 450,000 and 900,000 square miles, according to what one chooses to consider as belonging to Tibet. A large portion of Tibetan territory is entirely unmapped. There are white spots on the map covering tens of thousands of square miles, and even the mapped portion varies considerably, making the use of the existing maps very difficult. Besides, there are rapid physical changes. Many lakes shrink from year to year. Frequent and very violent earthquakes alter the surface of the earth. But no matter whether you know your exact location or not, you are in perhaps the strangest country in the world. Almost every moment one meets with something new, something unexpected. This makes life the really worth living. Is not the absence of certainty the greatest asset in life? How to get to Tibet? Foreigners are unwelcome. The dislike of the foreigner seems to be encouraged by the lamas. There are no other countries where 20% of the population live as priests at the expense of the remaining 80% as they do in Tibet. So the less the Tibetans get into contact with foreigners and the less they know about other countries, the better for the lamas. But there is yet another reason why foreigners are kept out. Every time a foreign expedition visits Tibet, trouble follows. The Tibetans are convinced that bad thoughts cause disease and that the bad thoughts of white people poison their country. Be that as it may, it is a fact that almost every time expeditions of white people have visited Tibet, some disaster has followed. The Tibetans declare that their presence offends the Tibetan gods and that their evil thoughts cause disease. In any case, the Tibetans know by experience that disasters follow the coming of white expeditions. To be on the safe side, they bar expeditions altogether. If their hands are forced and they find themselves confronted by a fait accompli, or if they are coerced into granting a permission, they take good care that the movements of the foreigners should be watched carefully and that people in the districts visited should know some time in advance of the coming of white people, so that the lamas may perform incantations and nullify the effect of possible evil influences. As early as 1932, my decision to travel in disguise in Tibet was taken. I knew that if I avoided the districts usually visited by white people, I had at least a slight chance to avoid being found out. The masses of the people in Tibet cannot read, and their ideas about the appearance of white people are vague. To make things easier, Tibetan clothes are wide and loose, and completely hide the form of the body and the somewhat un-Tibetan gait of a white person. As a matter of fact, Tibetan clothes are so loose that on cold nights many Tibetans carry about a burning stove hidden in the folds of their garments. Sometimes a fairly good-sized dog may be transported in the same way. The ignorance of the Tibetans about things and people outside Tibet is appalling and greatly facilitates travel in disguise. The most extraordinary ideas prevail about other parts of the world. Tibetan brigands with whom I had the amusing adventures recorded in Chapter 3 thought that white people carried about foodstuffs inside their heads. Tibetan nomads in whose tents I lived for a day also believed that Japan was an integral part of China and that Russia and America were more or less the same thing. Only when in the neighborhood of priests and monks I had to be on my guard. My only chance then was to pose as a deaf and dumb person. Long before leaving for Asia, I had realized the necessity of acquiring an immense resistance and staying power for my travels in Tibet. I had to traverse the district south from Iria, where not a single blade of grass grows over a distance of several hundred miles. Animals would not be of the slightest use there, since they would die on the way from lack of food. I was determined to penetrate into a part of the world where the explorer is faced with that greatest and seemingly most insuperable of difficulties, the impossibility of taking beasts of burden for transport purposes. So I had to use another method, precisely the same as that which I recently used for traversing the bleak lava region of the Odadrown in the uninhabited interior of Iceland, namely, that of carrying my food and equipment myself. Traveling unaccompanied by beasts of burden involved a hitherto unknown simplification of equipment and the cutting down of seemingly indispensable utensils and food reserves to an absolute minimum. To give an example, the food, warm clothing, camp, and other equipment carried by the Heart Expedition for every white person in the expedition for a period of 45 days, weighed 1,000 pounds per head. The maximum I could carry when traveling unaccompanied by beasts of burden was about 1/15th of that quantity. So I knew that in order to succeed I had to go into training to cover enormous distances on foot very quickly, so that a comparatively small supply of food taken along should last over a distance of many hundred miles. Furthermore, I had to reduce greatly the amount of food taken and to get used to living on uncooked food of the simplest kind to save the weight of cooking utensils. Moreover, I realized that if I could sleep in an unheated tent at a temperature many degrees under freezing point, I could keep away from Tibetan tents and Tibetan houses whenever I chose, even during those terribly cold Tibetan nights, thus minimizing the chances of detection. And living on uncooked food would also give me the advantage of being able to hide myself much more easily. There is nothing more dangerous for the solitary traveler than the lighting of a fire. Even if nothing worse happens, it may signal his presence to the many bandits who infest Central Asia, where robbery is considered a respectable sideline. As soon as my decision to travel in disguise in Tibet had been taken, I went into training. In the autumn of 1933, I twice covered a distance of 80 miles in 24 hours each. Late in the autumn, I began to walk longer distances at an average speed of 35 miles a day. One of these training trips was a walk from Malmö in the south of Sweden to Stockholm, a distance of about 400 English miles covered in less than 12 days, fully packed. The latter performance attracted the attention of the Swedish press, my photograph appearing in the first page of Dagens Nyheter, one of the largest Stockholm dailies, on November 3, 1933. Few people who read the long newspaper reports in which I was compared with Gandhi, on account of my frugal habits, realized that the performance was really part of training for a journey to uninhabited and inaccessible parts of Central Asia. Later in the year, one spent many nights in an unheated tent in northern Scandinavia at a temperature of many degrees under freezing point, and lived for many weeks on uncooked food of the simplest kind without taking any stimulants. One morning when I crawled out from the tent, the temperature was 50 Fahrenheit, 10°C, so the prospect of Tibetan nights had lost its terror. Soon afterwards I began to look out for suitable companions to accompany me to Central Asia. It sounds incredible that in a world where millions of people find time hanging heavily on their hands, it should have been impossible to find suitable companions for such an adventure. The few candidates who were up to my conditions physically, could not speak the many languages required for the journey or lacked the psychical and ethical qualifications necessary for successfully entering Tibet in disguise. Later on, the news that I intended to travel in Asia leaked out and I realized the impossibility of keeping my plans secret any longer. When I found the news had leaked out anyhow, I had no objection to its finding its way into the newspapers, as I hoped that publicity would help me to find suitable companions by enabling me to get in touch with a very large number of candidates, from whom I could make my selection. The Sunday Express was the first London paper to take an interest in the matter. Three articles were published about my expedition, the Sunday Express mentioning the fact that I was looking for companions to accompany me to Central Asia. The first article brought in hundreds of applications, many of them quite serious. Some applicants obviously exaggerated. One man wrote that he could walk 120 miles a day, but when I wrote him offering to put him to a test, he did not feel inclined to carry on further correspondence regarding the matter. Other applicants really meant business. A boy of 19 actually cycled up non-stop from Liverpool to London, in order to show me his powers of resistance. Unfortunately, before he was put to the final tests, someone in his family was taken seriously ill, forcing him to give up the plan of coming along. There were also lady applicants. One of them was particularly tenacious. She meant to take good care of me and all the other members of the expedition in Asia, and as I was not inhuman enough to put a woman to walking tests of 60 English miles a day while depriving her of all possibilities of taking her usual tonics, I even bantied during tests, I had to turn her application down right in the beginning. The good lady then came to my house every 10 minutes from morning till night, until everybody in the house was on the verge of hysteria. Before they were actually put to the most trying tests, few applicants realized what it means to travel in the most inaccessible parts of Central Asia, without the technical facilities and convenience usually considered indispensable for such a journey. From end to end, the expedition was based on simplification rather than complication. Tibetan yaks, for instance, travel at an average speed of only 2 miles an hour, and several hours are lost every morning in packing them. If one has no beasts of burden at all, one is ready in the morning in a few minutes, and then one starts at a speed of 4.5 miles an hour. This method of travel is just as simple as it is efficient. I have used it not only in Tibet, but also in the uninhabited interior of Iceland, where I averaged daily walks of 35 miles. My equipment included a very small and light device enabling me to cross rivers and lakes in any direction without attracting attention. The Empire News reel filmed me with the device for the weekly news in the English cinemas, and maybe some of my readers remember having seen me on the news reel. The film was taken at Finchley Open Air Swimming Pool, in the presence of some of the local authorities, and representatives of the local press. There were some funny accidents. Two different types of apparatus were tested and there were even spills, exciting spills, with people fully clothed falling into the water. When traveling in Asia, the device was hidden in a bag made of sheepskin. It often proved to be very useful. Only in a high wind it became very dangerous, as it easily got out of control.